I discovered something when I was in the sixth grade, in addition to girls. That was the fact that humor was an indispensable component in my chemistry. And what helped me discover that was Mad Magazine. Maybe some of you grew up reading that. My favorite was the back thing you would fold and create, you know, a different picture with that. But in particular, I learned that I love a particular kind of comedy, which is satire. I thank God for satire because that is what helped preserve my sanity through all that life has thrown my way. And as I was working on this message, I remembered a scene from the Monty Python film, The Meaning of Life, a hilarious scene that takes place in a British prep school chapel service. And I want you to listen carefully and read the subtext if you can't understand the British accent. Listen carefully to what it's saying about prayer and our image of God. Let's roll it.
Let us praise God. O Lord.
Louder. Prayer is not a laughing matter, although there are times when it speaks to us in such a way that we can step back and see the funny quirks of what it means to be you and me. Prayer is our communion and communication with God. Prayer grounds us and guides us. Prayer is our cry for help and our expression of gratitude. Prayer is more listening than talking. Prayer is the soul's sincere desire. Prayer sometimes is a supreme struggle. And this morning I want to name some of those struggles, some of those impediments which keep us from realizing what could become a very meaningful prayer life. The early church fathers, or as they are sometimes called, the desert fathers and mothers, wrote extensively about prayer because that is to which they devoted their lives. Going out in the desert for decades to live by themselves to pray for the world. And they did that because prayer was their deep desire and delight. And also they understood it was their necessity. And one of the desert fathers said, as a bird without wings, as a soldier without arms, so is a Christian without prayer. Some of you may have read some books by Bill Hybels, who was the founding pastor of the Willow Creek Church.
He's recently written a book called Too Busy Not to Pray. And that's an interesting title because it says, because our lives are so busy, we all the more need prayer. But there is an irony in that as well, because the more busy we are, the less likely we are to pray. Our lives are overstructured, overscheduled, overstuffed, such that we scarcely have not enough time to sleep or eat, let alone pray. We may want to pray, but feel bad because there are other urgent matters that call for our attention. This is what led Sue Kidd to say we live in a culture that promotes quickaholic spirituality. We want a meaningful prayer life, but Lord, give it to us fast. It's like going up to the drive-up window and ordering the McPrayer of the day. And Paul sets the stage for our thoughts here in Romans 2:26, where he says, likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness because we do not know how to pray as we ought. The disciples said as much when they asked Jesus, Lord, teach us how to pray. The French reformer John Calvin shared the belief that every person in every culture that has lived on the face of this earth longs to connect to a power beyond themselves, whether they have been told about God and the story of his son, Jesus Christ, or not. We are all predisposed to God. The urge to prayer comes as standard equipment on all models. But while the urge is there, knowing how to do it, well, that does not come. Oh Lord, we do not know how to pray as we ought, Paul said. And in that chaplain's prayer, there is impediment number one to having a meaningful life of prayer. Anybody remember the line in that prayer? What, especially the one that says, oh Lord, you are so big, so absolutely huge. And gosh, we're really all impressed down here, I can tell you. How is that an impediment? Where is God? See some of you going like this. God is up, we are stuck here. God is totally transcendent in this realm beyond time and space, while we are these lowly creatures who are just down here. And so how do we get the attention of a God who is totally other and totally transcendent? Hello, up there. I say, hello, is anybody home? Hello, do you hear me? When I was a kid, I was fascinated to learn that light travels at 186 miles per second, which comes to 700 million miles in an hour. And at night, I went out in the yard with my flashlight, powerful one, 2C batteries, and I would flash Morse code into the sky, which was a joke since I didn't even know Morse code. So I just put it in a rhythm, and I imagined those light beams streaking through space and perhaps one day being received by intelligent beings who would respond and send a message back. I said, man, wouldn't that be something? Until I realized that by the time they received the message and sent it and we received it, I would be about 2 million years old. And I didn't have that kind of time. So I turned my pursuits to more immediate things. See, if God is neither near nor interested in what happens on this earth, why pray? If God exists in some realm of fog and mist beyond time and space, what good is prayer? Why pour your heart into something if your prayers won't even punch through the atmosphere? See, that notion of up here and down there is an ancient idea that we have hung on to, that the first Soviet cosmonaut blew to smithereens. Remember what he said? He was up in space. There is no God up here. There is no heaven. Hence the weakness of the argument of up there. You know, we're just beginning to scratch the surface about all of the amazing, mysterious internet connections there are on this earth and in the universe and within the universe inside of us. And like the early spiritual writers, we're recognizing that there isn't up here and up there. There isn't a realm over here that is material and one over here that is spiritual. There is not sacred over here and sacred over there. It is all one, part of one totality. So we can say at one time that yes, God is wholly other and transcendent, but we also can use that other theological word, immanent, which means God is right here, right now, right pleased to be within every one of us. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. There is a fantastic oneness that God has made out of all creation, a oneness that doesn't separate us from God, but makes it possible for us to be linked with God if only we know how. Now, in that chapel scene, there is another impediment to prayer, and that is in the hymn. And tell me what that impediment is.
Fear.
Don't put us on the barbecue or stew us in the stock. Now, where does that come from? Well, what we've been told, what we have heard from very early on. Ruth Stroll told me of when she was a little girl that her parents would take her to revival meetings. You know, sawdust floors, the yellow bug lights, the whole thing, and fire would come from those preachers who warned about the righteous wrath of God and us getting what we deserve as sinful creatures. God knows if you've been bad or good, so you better be good for goodness sake. And poor little Ruth was scared to death when she left those meetings because she didn't know how to hold that image of God with what the 23rd Psalm told her, which her parents and Sunday school teachers told her to read, that surely your goodness and your mercy follow me all of the days of my life. So how do you reconcile this? It's not to say that we can make God whatever we want, because that kind of God would be too small, would do us no good and not give us anything close to the life that Jesus promised. You know, God's ways are not ours. And that alone is something to be grateful for. But many of those images that we have of God have been holdovers from a long time ago. Or maybe your understanding of God was initially shaped by your experience with authority figures. I have counseled and done spiritual direction with women who say, I cannot pray to God as Father. And when you explore the reasons why, you know that their fathers were tyrants who spoke abusively, maybe who treated them abusively, in those extreme cases, sexually violated them. And if that's the image of Father that you're taking into prayer, you can see that could be difficult. And how different it is to trust God when that comes naturally because you had parents who loved you unconditionally that you can trust, who protected you and who set boundaries for you and loved you no matter what you said or did. When I was pastoring in South Bend, Roberta Bondi was teaching at Notre Dame. She is an eminent church historian, but she has also written a lot about the subject of prayer. And in this great little book called In Ordinary Time, she talks about the will of God, not the way we talk about it. It is, you know, what is the will of God in this world of suffering? Is it the will of God that that little baby was shaken to death by the mother's boyfriend? No, that's not what she's talking about. She talked about the will of God in a way I had not considered. Now, as you think about the will of God being worked out in your life, what are the feelings? What are the emotions? What are the ideas that come to your mind for God's will to be worked in your life? Are those associations pleasant, exciting, or are they maybe a little bit foreboding? Because we, whatever the will of God is, we're sure it's nothing like what our will is. And we're sure that if we ask for God's will to take root in us, that we're going to lose a lot in the process. Our personalities will be obliterated. We will no more be the people we are. Bondi asks, why don't we marvel that God's will for us is life? That's what Jesus came to give, life, abundant life. John's gospel in the prologue said, in him was life, and the life was the light of everyone. Life is good, not because the t-shirts say life is good, but because God made it that way. And knowing that this is God's overarching reason for creation is what can lead us to pray. You know, our conception of where God is can be an impediment. Our understanding of what God's character is all about and how God feels about us can be an impediment. But there's one more I want to mention this morning. I want to ask, how many of you are atheists? Come on, now let's not be bashful. Come on, all atheists, raise your hands. I'm raising mine. I am an atheist, and so are you. Now that may come as a little bit of a surprise, but Parker Palmer, the spiritual writer, says we are all functional atheists. He says it's the unconscious, unexamined conviction that if anything is going to happen, I must be the one to make it happen. Functional atheists can talk about God, but they live as though there's no one else minding the store. And if anything good is going to happen, then we're going to have to make it happen. And I can tell you the logical consequence of functional atheism, and that is disillusionment and depression and despair. Because we discover early on that we cannot bend the world to our will. No matter how much good we do to alleviate the sufferings of the world, in total, things don't change very much. Rather than invite God to work through us, we get disillusioned. We think that ours is the only act in town. But what I would say is, why carry the world on your shoulders when God already holds it in his hands? You know, I've known wonderful people whose lives have been shaped by and guided by prayer. Prayer is what made Pat Hellman, Pat Hellman. Prayer is what makes Carolyn Egoff, Carolyn Egoff. Prayer is what makes Ruth Stroll, Ruth Stroll. Prayer is what makes the LaRues, the LaRues. Now, they would not pray to God if God was absolutely remote. They would not pray to a God who is a detached, unpredictable, judgmental tyrant. They wouldn't pray if they believed that every outcome was dependent upon them. Oh, yes, we do what we can, but we also pray for guidance and trust that the outcomes will ultimately come for the one who knows us best. Paul said, we do not know how to pray as we ought. But the Spirit intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words, with sighs and groans and with cries, because when words are inadequate to express what we feel, the sighs and groans are what take over. Ask Casey what it was like when he was trapped inside of his body and didn't have words to express what was going on and couldn't do the most basic communication. As I have said often, if you want to know where God is in your life, pay close attention to what brings a lump in the throat and a tear to the eye. And remember that prayer is not ultimately about words. Prayer is listening. And the spiritual teachers have repeatedly told us that the language of God is silence, not words, although sometimes that's all we have. And with those words, frustration is to be expected. But as a spiritual director once told me when I was being exceedingly frustrated that I wasn't really being at prayer the way I thought it should, she said, leave should and must and ought out of your vocabulary. Pray as you can, she said. Don't pray as you can't. I know someone who told this, an amusing story of a childhood vacation with his family. They drove from Illinois to California. Now, his father rarely made mistakes, and when he did make one, he was a master of covering it up so nobody would notice, and so it became a game for the kids to try and catch him. They were in the middle of the Mojave Desert when the air conditioning clunked out. The windows were down. It was over 100 degrees. They were sticking to their seats. All they could think about was a drink of ice water. And then they saw an amazing sight, because plunked down in the middle of a desert was a big yellow and black coin-operated ice house. There wasn't anything around it. There was nothing as far as you could see. So checking it out, his dad came back and said it cost 75 cents. I got two quarters. Anybody else have a quarter? And they scrounged around and came up with two dimes and a nickel. And so dad walked back to the ice house. He rarely got excited over anything, and his emotions were almost always in check. But then they heard him holler, "Nuts!" and stomping his feet as he stood there with a 20-pound block of ice at his feet. He had pushed the block button instead of the cube button. And there he stood in the middle of the desert, dying of thirst with no more change and staring at an unwanted block of ice. Oh, was he ticked. But just as he made his way to the car, he heard a voice from inside the ice house that said, "Can I help you, mister?" In every moment of our lives, God is at hand, especially when we pray. When we make royal messes of ourselves or end up getting what we prayed for only to discover that we really don't want it and don't need it, and can't use it, there's God asking, "How can I help?" And so you see, one of our tasks is to look for ice houses in the middle of the desert. As my spiritual director said, when you pray, don't think in terms of ought and must as should. Thank God for those nudges that you feel within you to try. Start small. Don't say, "I commit to praying an hour every day, starting at 4 a.m. If you're a morning person, fine. If you're an evening person, fine. But start out small. Start with 5 minutes of what you can try to have as undivided attention. Oh yeah, there will be all kinds of distractions. That's given because there isn't a shutoff switch in our brain. But keep it simple. Keep it small. Tell God what's on your mind. Not that God doesn't know already. but that in hearing yourself pray it, you make yourself available. With no apprehension, say what's on your mind as you would with a friend who knows all about you and in whose company you can spend time without saying a word. Do you have friends like that? That you can just while away the minutes or maybe an hour in one another's presence and no one has to say a word because there is that unspoken communication, a friendship between you. No, we do not know how to pray as we ought, Paul says. But I want to leave you with these thoughts of Roberta Bondi, which I take as great words of encouragement. She said, prayer is a pretty ordinary, everyday kind of thing. It has high moments, but a lot of prayer is just a matter of showing up, being there in the presence of a God who loves you.